a wild ride through Australia, flying high with a woman lost to history and an Indigenous coming-of-age story. This is Chapter 211 of WCBS Author Talks. I'm Lisa Cherenkovich, and coming up, Adrian McKinty shares how crappy B-horror movies from the 70s shaped his imagination and his thriller writing. Don Daler introduces us to a woman we should know but don't because of a historical fluke. And young adult debut novelist Jen Ferguson shares why her book is for any reader who has big feelings. In his new summer thriller, The Island, best-selling Uber driver-turned-author Adrian McKinty will have you wondering, what would you do if you accidentally killed someone? Set on a remote Australian island, his domestic thriller pits family against family in a fight for survival. And believe it or not, his story is based on a personal, real-life incident. So when I've been talking to people and telling them about this last book I've read, I've been calling it a mashup of Survivor meets Deliverance meets Steve Irwin Crocodile Hunter.
That's good. Yeah, that works for me.
So I find it really fascinating that the germ from the story started is something that actually happened to you in real life, but maybe didn't go as far.
No, absolutely. We lived in Australia for 10 years, and I was always taking the kids and the missus, sometimes reluctantly, on long road trips. And speaking of Mad Max, we went up to the place where they filmed Mad Max is just about an hour north of Melbourne. So we went to all those roads and that landscape. It was amazing. And if you go about another 5 or 6 hours further north, you're into that landscape where they filmed The Road Warrior, Mad Max 2. So I was always up for these adventures. On one of the ventures, this one wasn't quite as successful. We went to this island off the coast of Victoria, and we got the ferry over. It was February in Australia, so it's about 42, 43 degrees Celsius, which is about 112 Fahrenheit. And it's that no ozone layer Australian heat where it just bakes down on you. So we got this ferry over, and it was immediately weird because there's an island nearby where a lot of tourists go called Phillip Island, where they have these little fairy penguins that a lot of people are interested in. But that had no interest to me because it's where the tourists went. So I went to this off-the-beaten-track place, which I called Dutch Island in the book. And it was strange immediately because when we got the ferry over, the guy driving the ferry was driving it with his foot and drinking a can of beer. He was driving the little steering wheel thing, tiny little wheel with his foot, drinking a can of beer. Meanwhile, telling us about these shark-infested waters that were filled with tiger sharks and blue sharks. And so I was thinking, you know, if something goes wrong, if you capsize the ferry here, aren't we all dead? But that didn't seem to bother him. And we land. And then it got a bit weirder because the very first thing we see was two guys walking around with shotguns over their shoulders. And you never see long guns in Australia because they have incredibly strict gun controls. You see cops sometimes with revolvers, but you never, ever see long guns. So that was extremely peculiar. And then we heard a lot of gunfire all over the island because they were extirpating the local rabbit population, we found out later. But just so weird, the first thing you see is these guys with the shotguns, and then you hear all this gunfire everywhere. And I thought, okay, fair enough. We're driving on this road, and there's nothing to see. It's just this tall spinifex grass that they have there in Oz, this sort of yellowy, white, brittle grass. And the kids have checked out. There's no Wi-Fi or phone signal, but they're on these little portable DVD player things. So they're in the back seat doing that. And the wife's looking at me just going, well, Adrian, this is another fine mess you've got us into, this place. So we stopped at this farm to get some drinks of water or whatever. And then that's when the oddness all kicked up another notch because at the farm, they knew everything about us. Like we'd come from Melbourne, who we were, you know, ages of our kids and everything. And it turns out the guy in the ferry had walkie-talkied our information to them. And it turns out everyone on this island was related. They were all one large extended family. So that was odd, that they all knew all about us. And then one of the guys, I didn't hear this, but my wife overheard it, said inappropriate comment about one of my daughters. Leah says to me, look, let's just get out of here. And we'd driven around and we'd seen what there was to see. And I said, yeah, let's go. And then I looked at my watch and it was 3:10. And the guy driving the ferry had been incredibly strict with us. He said, the last ferry goes at 3:30. I don't take anybody back after then. And I thought, oh my God, we might have to sleep in the car on this island overnight. What a nightmare. So I said, kids, quickly get in the car. We got in the car, Leah got in the front seat, and I floored it. And I'm driving down this road towards the ferry, just flooring it. And then suddenly, out of the Spinifex, this tall grass, a lady on a bicycle comes, just turns right out in front of us on the road. And, your adrenaline's going really hard and you memorize all the details. And I noticed that she was wearing a hearing aid, but the hearing aid must have been turned on or the battery was dead or something, because I honked the horn and slammed on the brakes. And so she was like here, and we were coming like here, and the car just shuddered to a halt. And then she kept on going down the road and completely oblivious, never knew that we were there. And we had missed her by 9-10 yards. And I am shaking at the steering wheel, as you do after any kind of road accident, anything involving a car, you're always like, and I was just shaking at the steering wheel. And to sort of break the tension a bit, I said to the missus, if we'd hit her, we would never have got off this island alive. And she said perfectly seriously, I don't think we would have. And so a few years later, when I was in New York and I was trying to think of another book to write, I had signed this 2-book deal with Little Brown. And there'd been some talk about me doing a sequel to The Chain, and I, which is my last book, and there's no way I was ever going to do that because I love the way that ended. It had a beginning, a middle, and an end, and I didn't want to do a sequel. But then I thought, well, maybe this could be a sort of thematic sequel. This family on the run on this island, and unlike in real life where we didn't hit her, they do hit her. And then you have all the moral dilemmas, all the tension, all the drama, these Americans in this world of which they know nothing. And it's kind of a fight to survive, but also it's a family struggle as well. Did you ever see the Al Pacino movie, Any Given Sunday?
Maybe a while back.
Football movie, and there's a bit where the team is in complete dysfunction and chaos before the big game, and Pacino gives this fantastic speech where he talks about, we have to heal ourselves first before we can go out and do battle with the other team. And I was thinking, yeah, this family has to heal itself as well as survive in this island, and they have to do the healing before they can do anything else. And so I really love that idea. And I love that idea of sort of motherhood and this very far too young woman who shouldn't really have any responsibility for these kids at all is driven into this horrible situation of having to look after these kids. In fact, not even just look after them, but save their lives. And so I like those sort of connections with my previous book, even though it's got nothing really to do with the previous book at all.
I'm glad to hear, though, that you see it as sort of a thematic sequel, because I was reading this book and I'm thinking, I love The Chain, that you either are like, you like to put parental figures through the ringer because you did that in The Chain, you do that in this one. And it kind of got me wondering, like, are you one of those dads who like always imagine the worst case scenario and this is your therapy to like write it out and get it all out there?
Absolutely. I imagine like the worst case happening. And I love doing those family road trips, but you should see the level of over preparation I do. Like I have like a jug of water, like a 10-gallon jug of water, spare gasoline. You know, I have actual paper maps in case Wi-Fi goes out, and you know, I have an actual physical compass as well. In case, I mean, nothing has ever, touch wood, nothing has ever really gone wrong. But yeah, I really do over prepare. And it's funny you mentioned Deliverance, because I think maybe those kind of movies warp my head a bit, because I grew up in the 80s. I grew up in the 80s, and all those, the videos that we watched were all those 70s videos that were in the video stores back then, the 80s and 90s. And in Britain and Ireland, we had this category of films called video nasties. And they were the videos that were so bad that they couldn't even be rated and shown in movie theaters. So there was like the, in the UK, I think there was the U rating, there was PG, there was 15, then there was the X rating. And then there were the unrated films that were so depraved, no one was ever allowed to see them. So when you're a 12-year-old boy, that's all you ever wanted to see. Like, you went straight to the unrated video nasty section of the video store. So I remember just seeing these films far, far too young, and films much worse than Deliverance. Like I Spit on Your Grave and Last House on the Left and Texas Chainsaw and these horrific movies, but with all the same theme: never leave your house. If you go outside the city, these people are waiting for you. And so I think that probably put this deep paranoia into my brain.
Well, you've made me a little bit paranoid, because after reading this book, I kind of want to go take a survivalist course somewhere and like be that overprepared person with the extra water and the paper maps and the extra gas.
It's so funny. The one of the movies is I Spit in Your Grave, which is not a good movie by any stretch of the imagination. It's a terrible film. It's a real just exploitation movie from the 70s. But the idea of the movie is simple. A writer who lives in Manhattan goes to a cabin in upstate New York to finish her new book, and then meets the locals and terrible things happen. And then the whole final act of the movie is her at war with the people in the cabin. And the number of times people have offered me cabins in upstate New York to go write it, and I've just said no, because I'm sure it would be lovely and I would have a great time up there and I would get so much work done. But just that movie's playing in my head. So Adrian, you were warned. You're now a writer who lives in Manhattan, and you're going to take this cabin in upstate New York? Are you crazy?
Listen, I'm a native New Yorker. You couldn't pay me all the money in the world to go live in an upstate New York cabin.
Yes,
I exactly. Like the city where there are lots of people you could hide amongst.
Yes, that's true.
So, you know, you have this crazy family living on this island, and mm-hmm. I do like how you mess with the reader's head, because at a certain point of the book, you have a second guessing whether or not they're really bad.
Right.
But I do want to say that amongst all of them, you have this one, I would call her a good character. She's a kid. So you've got her. She's blood of this family, but she really seems to be like the only good egg, which kind of leads you to think, you know, even if it, like the whole nature versus nurture kind of conversation.
I knew I had to make them bad, because otherwise there could be a negotiated settlement to all this. So I had to make them bad, but I didn't want to make them one dimensionally bad. So I tried to make Nev a little bit more dimensional, and I tried to make Matt a little bit more dimensional. Mm-hmm. And then I also didn't want to be, the ugly American writing about Australia and making them all just to be monsters. So I totally cheated. And I made Ma come from Belfast, which is where I'm from. And I thought, well, no one can accuse me of being the ugly American now, because this is an interior critique and you're allowed to do interior critiques, you know, in this kind of novel. So that's a total cheat. That was an absolute cop out. But, I had to do that to get away with that story. And then, yeah, as you say, you know, within that, there's this, you know, little interesting dimension. And also, I think I thought it was important that Matt makes the speech. I think it's Matt. Maybe it's one of the other characters. I can't remember. But says, look, we're not the bad guys. You came over here to our home and did a terrible thing and then tried to cover it up. Like, you're the bad guys here. And as a reader, it's gone so far by that stage, you're going, don't listen to this guy. You know, don't be swayed by this. But still, you know, it's put out there, you know, that is actually physically true. And so, yeah, it's you wanted to give it a little bit more moral texture.
I know you had a lot of interest for The Chain for a screen adaptation. Are you getting that kind of attention for this one as well?
Yeah, I mean, it's been optioned by Hulu, and their plan is to do a limited series and on this.
I'd watch the heck out of that.
Very exciting. I kind of don't think they could actually film on the real island itself. I was actually thinking about this morning. I said, wouldn't it be awesome if they went there and filmed in the real island with the real people as extras? And, you know, but then I thought, but there's no resources on this island for a film production. I mean, there's no fresh water. There's barely any roads. There's no electricity. There's no Wi-Fi service. So my guess is that would just be physically impossible. Mm-hmm. You just actually couldn't do that. I mean, where are the actors going to go in their downtime? There's no power for any of the trailers. So I was thinking, wouldn't that be awesome? And then I think, but that would probably never, ever happen because the location is just so, it's just so extreme.
Oh, maybe there's a California desert somewhere that
probably
can stand.
I mean, I'm sure that's there'll be plenty of little or an island. I was thinking maybe an island off the Carolina coast or something, or somewhere like that. You know,
import a koala bear too.
Yeah, get a few koalas and kookaburras in the trees.
So, how do you plan on torturing parents next?
Well, I have a couple of different plans for the next book. And I'm probably going to spend this summer seeing which one of those two is the best goer. But I don't want to say too much about it now because I don't want to jinx it. I've got two ideas that I'm not going to do both. Absolutely not. But I'm going to do one or the other of them over the next few weeks. I'm just going to make a decision and do it.
All right. Well, I know even if you don't, I mean, you're not going to tell us anything, but I know that when the time comes, it's going to be a great summer read that will keep us on the edge of our seat for the entire length of the book.
Oh, thank you very much. I was just going to say one more thing. Anytime I would get stuck in, and this is true, and it's a terrible thing to say, but anytime I would get stuck in The Chain or The Island, and that didn't happen much. I mean, both books sort of flowed fairly easily. But anytime I would get stuck, I would always say to myself, what's the worst thing that could happen now? And then I would just go, ah, this would be very, very bad. And then I would start writing it. So that's probably what I'm going to use for the next one as well. Just what's the worst thing that could happen now to these poor, poor people?
All those horrible movies you watched are like just come, all that time you spent, if your mom or your dad thought you were wasting your life away, it is now all coming to fruition.
Yes, you were totally wrong.
Exactly. Watch those movies all summer long. Adrian McKinty, thank you so much for your time today. Go out and get The Island. It's really enjoyable.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
If I say historic female aviator, what's the first name that pops into your head? Odds are, it's Amelia Earhart. But it turns out a woman named Harriet Quimby was sitting in the pilot seat decades before Earhart ever did. In fact, Quimby was one of Earhart's inspirations. So why do so few people know about her? A lot of it has to actually do with a cruel twist of fate. But author and news correspondent Don Daler seeks to shine a light on Quimby's accomplishments in his new book, Fearless, Harriet Quimby, A Life Without Limits. I first discovered Harriet by picking up this book and reading it. Tell me how you first stumbled across her and her story.
I know you know this. As a reporter, you end up reading a lot of obscure things. It's just kind of like an addiction that we have. Some of it is looking for stories, and some of it is just, I think what drives us as journalists is just a curiosity about the world and about other people. I mean, that's really what has been my main focus most of my life, is just things that I didn't know that I want to know. So I was reading this obscure aviation journal years ago when I was living out in Los Angeles, and I stumbled upon a few paragraphs about this amazing woman that I was shocked that I'd never heard of before. Because when you look at actually all the things that she did in the, you know, the early 1900s, when people just weren't doing these things, it was amazing to me that nobody knew about her and that I personally didn't know about her. So I started doing a little bit more digging, not with anything, you know, behind that other than just curiosity. And the more I found out about her, the more I was fascinated. So eventually I wrote a screenplay about her. I was living in LA. That's what people do in LA. You know, people have lattes in New York. People write screenplays. So that's what I did. I actually had a degree in screenwriting, so I knew a little bit about what I was doing, but it got optioned by a major producer in Hollywood, a guy named Bill McDonald, who did Sliver and a number of other really big movies. But as you know, what's often the case, he wasn't able to raise enough money to make the movie. So it kind of languished. And then years later, I'd written a couple and published a couple novels. And years later, I was talking with my agent about, you know, what are we going to do next? I had a couple ideas about new novels and things. And for whatever reason, Harriet Quimby popped into my brain during that conversation. And I mentioned the story to her, and she was blown away. She had never heard, like most of us had never heard about this woman and her accomplishments. And, you know, the more I told her, the more she said, you've got to do this. You've got to do this. I said, I've never written a nonfiction. I've never written a biography. She said, you're a journalist. This is what you do. You can do this. Just, you know, wrote up a proposal, and within a week we had a publisher who was in on it, which was just incredible. Because as you know, getting any interest in a new book is impossible. It's just the hardest thing in the world, is to get a publisher interested in something you've written. So to have a reaction that quickly was just really encouraging to us to delve into this project.
So considering it was a screenplay first, and then you had to tweak it for a book format and pitch it, what's your sales pitch for readers to pick up this book?
This is one of the most amazing people, not just woman, people you've never heard of. The things that she did were so far ahead of her times. I mean, she was born on a dirt farm in Michigan, had nothing, was the poorest of the poor. Her family moved to California, and she discovered that she was talented in writing. So she started contributing articles to the San Francisco Chronicle and the San Francisco Call, and got published. And that led to her eventually becoming a correspondent for Leslie's Illustrated Weekly in New York City, which in its day was like the People magazine of the time. It was very popular, and she wrote about everything. She traveled the world as a foreign correspondent. You know, she wrote on women's issues. She wrote about automobiles, which were new. And then eventually she turned her sight. So my pitch about Harriet Quimby and this book Fearless is, her story should be known. Her name should be mentioned in the same breath as Amelia Earhart. She was that kind of a trend breaker, but because of a twist of fate, nobody knows about her. She's not in most of the history books, and she disappeared. And I think that's wrong. And I'm hoping that people will know and give her her rightful due.
I know she kind of got a taste of what aviation or the early days of aviation was like by writing a story. Did you feel any sort of kinship? Because I know that there've probably been stories that you've gone out on that's piqued your interest. You're like, you know what, maybe I'm going to try this and really get into it. And then you eventually end up doing stories about doing this thing, right?
That's so true. You know, and honestly, that's one of the best things about being a journalist, is it takes you into different worlds, and you meet different people whom you had no idea the incredible things that they were doing. So I love that part of journalism. I love the discovery. I love the meeting people and hearing their stories. So Harriet was probably first introduced to aviation when the first air show came to the United States. And it was at a place called Dominguez Field in Los Angeles. And it was in 1910. And there are some reports that she was there to research an article. She never wrote an article about that air show. We don't know why. But she had been kind of following the development, the science of aviation. She wrote an early article in 1909. She wrote about a Japanese, he ended up being a Japanese spy for the Japanese military, who had come to the U.S. to study our buzzards because they were trying to develop aircraft. Now, keep in mind, the Wright brothers first flew in 1903. So this wasn't that much later than when they first flew. And they and this person was looking at the flights of buzzards, single wing creatures, by the way. The Wright brothers flew a biplane. And she found out about it and did a story about this guy, interviewed him. And that's what really, I think, first piqued her interest. And then she was given the assignment in 1910 to go to the Belmont Aviation Meet on Long Island. And she went there and she saw the huge crowds. There was so much interest in aviation in the day, even though people were still trying to figure it out. They were inventing ridiculous looking aircraft with multiple wings or with a circular whirly thing, or, you know, I mean, they are flapping wings even. People didn't know, scientists didn't yet know everything about aviation. So it was very much in the learning stage. But she went to this and she watched a race. And it was the inaugural Statue of Liberty race where these pilots were to fly. It was a time trial. They were to fly from the field in Belmont and fly around Statue of Liberty and come back, and whoever did it fastest won. And there was a guy named John Moisson, who was this really handsome daredevil, former soldier of fortune, just kind of the person who would be attracted to risky, life-threatening adventures like this, who won it by breaking all the rules. He flew over Brooklyn when everybody went around it because they were afraid they would crash into the church spires and things like that. And he won this thing, and that inspired her to learn. So she confronted him that night at a restaurant and said, "You're going to teach me how to fly." And he's like, "You're a woman." And she said, "I don't care. I'm going to learn how to fly." And his little sister, Mathilde, raised her hand and said, "Well, if you're teaching her, you're teaching me." Harriet was the first woman in America to get a pilot's license. Mathilde was the second.
You obviously did tons of research for this book. Is there stuff like, where did you go? What did you tap? And is there, I'm sure that there, you have a pile of things that you couldn't even get into the book because there was just so much there.
It's so rich. It's so true. It's such a rich period of our history. I mean, you think about the fact that a year before Harriet started her pilot's lessons, 100 pilots perished in crashes because they didn't know what they were doing. The science wasn't there yet. The physics weren't understood yet. So these brave, courageous, fearless people were pioneers in this science. And they took chances and they knew the risks. She knew the risks when you started this. I had a box of the research from way back in LA when I did the screenplay. And I don't know how. Maybe I'm a hoarder. I don't know. But I still have that box of research. So that was the good basis for it when the publisher came on from Princeton's Press and said, you know, we want to do this. So I had that. But there was so much more available now than was available back then because of computers and the digitalization of newspapers, New York Times and the Boston Herald, all these newspapers that had done these stories in there. I would advise people not to launch a research project during a pandemic because all of a sudden I couldn't go to the government buildings. I couldn't go to even libraries. They were all shuttered. And so the places where I had been spending all this time, you know, on the old style of microfiche and things like that, I didn't have access to that. But luckily, there was so much available online on digital archives and things like that, that I spent a lot of time just researching online. And you know, it's really funny. I the way that things work with journalists, and I know you this, is a one little thread that you start pulling at leads to five threads, and that leads to 100 threads. And that's what happened. I actually just on Facebook found the granddaughter of the man who taught Harriet how to fly.
Oh, wow.
And she gave us so much information and family stories and photographs and things like that. I mean, that's how journalism works. It's like you start scratching at this little thing and it starts leading to other things. And that's what's so fun about it. And the detective work that is so fulfilling. And, you know, I heard through the grapevine that there was actual film footage of Harriet's attempt to cross the channel. I couldn't find it anywhere. And it took forever. And I found it in the National Australian Film Archives, had one copy of this film. And I have no idea why it ended up there and why it wasn't elsewhere. But I tracked that down. And it's so wonderful to watch because she's alive. She's not just photographs and stories. She's this living human being, you know, and she's, before she gets on the plane, she has her girlfriends come up and, you know, she adjusts her scarves and everything and then climbs on board the plane.
And her purple fly suit, right? It's a purple yes. fly suit that she likes to wear.
That flight suit that she designed is one of the many things that sets her apart. She knew that being the first woman to take flying lessons was going to get attention. Because she was in the media. So she knew these things were going to garner attention. So she was friends because she was also a drama critic and theater critic and was in that societal kind of realm. She had a friend who was one of the leading designers, clothing designers of the day. So she talked him into helping her design a flight suit. And she said, I want it to be able to disguise my gender at first, but then I want it to look good. So it had purple silk with a wool backing because, you know, they were sitting in basically a wooden canvas plane in a lawn chair out in the open. So it was cold up there at the altitude. So she had to have it warm. It had a hood and it went down into her long calf length boots and it was plum colored silk, gorgeous color. But what she did was she designed it where there was a hidden cord that she could pull. And it flowed from pantaloons into a gown because she had awesome. To look good when the time came. And it's funny because while she was taking lessons, she was almost finished with her lessons. And her plane, she was going on takeoff and one of the wheels hit a mound and it crumpled the undercarriage. And it was a minor crash, didn't hurt her, didn't do anything like that. But there were some reporters nearby who were covering the early days of aviation and they came running over. And Harriet climbs out of the plane and they come screeching up to a halt, staring at her. And she pulls her hood down, pulls the cord, it flows into the gown, and she introduces herself to them. And the next day, the New York Times said, woman in pants flying on Long Island. And she was outed at that moment, but it became the big thing. She was concerned. And the reason that she hid what she was doing is because there was so much resistance in the day to women doing things that men do. I mean, women couldn't even vote. They weren't supposed to drive cars.
She did that too, right?
She did. She was one of the first women to not only learn how to drive a car, but she owned cars. She owned one when she lived out in San Francisco. And then when she moved to New York, she owned a little yellow convertible, what they called a runabout then. And she would drive around and she loved speed. She did a story about the precursor of the Grand Prix auto racing. And she talked her way onto a race car during a time trial, one of the early time trials, and went over 100 miles an hour. Now, this was a day when cars went 8 miles an hour, when the speed limit in most places were 10 miles an hour. And she went over 100 miles an hour. That shows really the kind of courage that this woman had. She was absolutely amazing and just would not let, you know, the clergy of the day, the politicians, or any of the societal restraints stop her from pursuing what she knew that she could do.
I want to keep some of her mystery because I think your book is full of all these great little stories. But I did want to note that I found it very ironic that she is a journalist on one of the day that she should have been front page news. She was scooped by probably one of the biggest stories of the century, which I think is every every reporter's fear is that you have the big story and just like that, because of circumstance, something happens. But we're going to keep that a secret because I want people to read that in the book because you don't expect it.
You don't, you know, and in all honesty, that's why we don't know her name. That's why she's not in the history books. It's because what she did, her greatest accomplishment happened when one of the greatest tragedies in the world happened. And so all the newspapers all over the world had other headlines. Whereas had that not happened, had that tragic twist of fate not happened, she would have been on the front page of every newspaper in the world. She would have had a ticker tape parade in New York City. She would have had speeches. And honestly, there would be schools named after her. I totally believe that. She was so far ahead of her time. And this little twist of fate stopped the world from knowing her story. And I'm really sincerely hoping that we all know her name now.
What do you want readers to take away from the life she lived and the things she was able to accomplish?
Harriet Quimby said it in her own words. If you are afraid, you will never succeed. It's natural to be concerned. It's natural to realize that what I'm doing has risks. But what she decided was, within reason and being careful, because she was one of the first pilots to do what's called a pre-flight check, where she herself, not her mechanic, she checked every bolt and wire on her airplane. So she said, I'm not being reckless. I'm being careful. But don't be afraid to pursue your dreams. Don't be afraid to do what society tells you you can't do. Do what you believe you can do and enjoy the results of that. Just enjoy the joy that comes from trying something that everybody says you can't do.
She was a woman born in the wrong time. She really was.
Can you imagine? She was so incredibly intelligent. You think about the fact that she grew up in a one-room schoolhouse in the lower peninsula of Michigan, got the basics of education, but her mother said, you're not going to be limited by your station in life. The fact that we're poor is not going to limit you. So her mother made sure that she learned much more than this one little single room schoolhouse would teach her. And Harriet continued to read voraciously and learn. So she was incredibly well-educated, but it was self-education. When you read her articles that she wrote, and she wrote about 250 articles over a period of 9 or 10 years, they're so beautifully written and so descriptive. And some of it is so obvious that she saw beyond the place where she was. She was fascinated by other cultures. She ended up traveling the world when it was a very unusual thing to do. She went to Africa and Egypt and Latin America and Bahamas and places like that when travel took months to get anywhere, but she did that. And I really think that she might've been an astronaut if she was in our day and age. I really do. I think that's the kind of person that she was. And we see it now, a direct line between the female astronauts today, astronauts in general, but the female astronauts today and Harriet Quimby. There is a direct line. Amelia Earhart herself credits Harriet Quimby with inspiring her to want to learn how to fly. And she said what Harriet did in 1912, crossing the English Channel in what was little more than a skeleton of ash wood and canvas and a lawn chair, took more courage than what Amelia Earhart did flying solo across the Atlantic Ocean.
Well, I hope now that people have heard you talk about Harriet Quimby, we've piqued their interest to pick up the book and learn even more. We've been talking with Don Daler. The new book is Fearless, Harriet Quimby, A Life Without Limit. Thank you so much for bringing this woman to our attention.
I'm so glad you're doing this, and I hope people read the book for the main reason that we need to know more about this woman. She deserves all the credit.
In her debut young adult novel, author Jen Ferguson introduces us to a young Indigenous woman named Lou, who's desperately trying to hang on to the sweetness of one last summer before she and her friends go away to college. But when a letter from her biological father threatens the life she and her family have, she'll have to confront the bitter truth. I got to chat with Jen about how important representation in fiction is and why she had to write The Summer of Bitter and Sweet. So usually I start off all these interviews with asking some sort of variation on a question about what inspired an author to write a story. But with this book, it really feels like instead of having an inspiration to write the story, there was a need to write it. Am I wrong?
No, I don't think you're wrong. Not at all.
Tell us a little bit about what led to you putting this story on paper.
Okay, so I've been writing novels for a really long time. Like, I was the teenager who was writing novels in her bedroom instead of going out and hanging with her friends. And I'd written about 7 novels as an adult and kept getting feedback from agents saying that they were beautiful, but they couldn't sell them, or they were beautiful, but they didn't fall in love. So I was actually thinking about quitting writing before I wrote this book. And I was talking to a good friend of mine, Jamie Pacton, who is a YA author. And Jamie and I had been talking about a lot of things, about writing, about my own sort of new understanding of my sexuality, and about sort of a lot of the colonial trauma I was going through in my early 30s. After having been through the Canadian education system and trying to understand myself as a Métis person who also has white ancestry. And Jamie sort of said, why don't you write that? And that was the moment where this book came together. I had to take the things that I was going through and funnel them into the book. And this book turned out to be the book that everyone wanted to represent and the book that people wanted to publish.
So you mean there is something in that whole old cliche about writing what you know?
Well, there definitely is, right? So for me as a fiction writer, I tend to borrow things from my friends and family and the world around me. And usually I'll throw out a disclaimer. I'll be like, oh, you just told me a really great story. That may end up in a novel at some point in time. And the combination of writing the things you know around you and then playing and fictionalizing and changing things so that your story shape works better. That's the joy of fiction writing.
And what you've done here with this book is you've written a book for other girls like you who, while growing up, and I know you said you were a voracious reader, you didn't see stories that reflected who you were. And just tell me why it's so critical to have a story like this and to see yourself represented in fiction.
Of course. So one of the things about the sort of changing landscape of particularly children's literature is that we are starting to see more and more people represented who were never represented before. And I was a late bloomer. I was a late bloomer coming to understand myself as demisexual. And I was a late bloomer, like, shucking off the colonial baggage that I was carrying around. And part of the reason why it took me so long to get there was that I didn't have books and media that, like, showed me that these things were normal, or showed me experiences of a particular character doing a similar thing. So there's so much power in being able to read a story and to identify with the character's experience, to see a part of yourself reflected in them. You're never going to see your exact journey reflected in any character, even if you share the same marginalization with them, but to be able to see them carrying around something that you also identify with is incredibly powerful for identity development, especially in children and young adults.
And I think this is the point where maybe I should backtrack a little bit and ask you to tell us about who Lou is and what her story is.
Of course. So Lou is 18 years old and she's just graduated from high school. This book takes place sort of the last week of high school throughout Labor Day weekend. Lou is Métis on her mother's side, and her biological father is a white settler. So Lou is working for her family's organic dairy and ice cream shack business for the summer with her first and recently ex-boyfriend. her best friend, Florence, who was going through some mental health crisis of her own that summer. And then her former best friend, King, returns to town after 3 years with no contact. And so this sounds like a lot is already going on in Lou's life. And then she receives a letter from her biological father, and he is getting out of prison and he wants to have a relationship with her. And this is something that Lou just absolutely does not want, but does not know how to deal with.
It is a lot. But I guess when you take a step back and think about it, when you're a teenager, there really is a lot going on, and a lot of it's not in your control.
So that's one of the things that I've been reflecting on a lot lately. The fact that when I was a teenager, I had a pretty, I had a stable home life. Like, I had good friends. I didn't have problems in school. School was really easy for me. When I had a job, it was great. But what I'm realizing as teens today, and like, we don't even have to look at the pandemic. We can even put that aside, and they still have so much on their shoulders. The world is louder for teens today, and it's louder than it was for me. And it's certainly louder than it was for people of my parents' generation. So people who sort of say like, there's a lot going on in that book, there's a lot going on in teens' lives. This is just sort of realism.
I think too, a lot of American readers might be surprised to learn while reading this book, and also just in some news stories that have started to pop up over the last year or so, about how dark of a history Canada has with its Indigenous people and how much it parallels what happened in this country.
Yeah, so I really struggle with Americans when they seem to think Canada is like this bright, shining, polite example of something, because the border between our two nations doesn't really change a lot when it comes to how the colonial powers worked and how they continue to work, particularly on Indigenous peoples. But that's not the only people that colonial governments act against, right? So there is an ongoing human rights crisis of missing, murdered Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people that is acknowledged in Canada and talked about in Canada, that we're just only starting to talk about in the U.S. And that human rights crisis is happening here as well.
And these Indigenous women and angry girls, you've dedicated your book to them.
Yeah, I wrote the dedication last. It was like the very last thing I wrote. And because there's so much going on in the summer of Bitter and Sweet, I've struggled to give it an elevator pitch. I struggled to tell people what it's about. And so it was this moment when I was finished and I was like, oh, I'm writing for teen girls who are angry about the world or angry about what they have to carry. I'm writing for Indigenous girls who are not just carrying like all the regular teen girl stuff, but they're carrying the insidious racism of the prairies or of where they live on their shoulders. And they're carrying taking care of their family and their community on their shoulders. So I realized I was really writing for girls and angry girls and girls who felt like there was too much in their lives, because that's Lou, and that's what Lou's going through.
Now, all that being said, you admit that Lou is not your favorite character in the book, and it's it's her best friend who disappeared for 3 years and now has come back. Why is that?
So Lou might have a bit too much of me in her for me to like be able to love her unconditionally. That might be something I need to talk to my therapist about. But also, King he's 18 and he's through some of the garbage that Lou is still going through, right? Like, he's dealt with his sexuality. He knows who he is. He understands himself as a Black Canadian. He doesn't have like big trauma around this anymore. Like, he's through a lot of the things that she's going through, and he is a solid, emotionally literate teen man. And I find that really, really, really lovable. that he can understand others and that he can figure out what others need, and he can still go for what he wants at the same time.
And you've had people say to you that he's too good of a guy, right?
Yeah. So like a number of the literary agents who offered to represent me were like, I have teen boys. This is not what teen boys look like. Like, teen boys are horrible and smelly. And I was like, yeah. It's also a book, right? And I've also met teen boys who are emotionally literate and have things together in a way that some other teens don't have together yet, right? So like, that can be realism too. And like, I love like a bad boy in literature, but that's not who Lou needs. Like, that's not who she needed in this book. She needed someone who was going to be patient with her and then push her when she needed to be pushed.
Who's the ideal reader for this story?
So I wrote it for teens, for sure. I wrote it for Indigenous teens, for sure. But I think the ideal reader for this story is anyone who likes big feelings and wants to examine the world that we live in a little more in a safe way, like with a book on their couch under a blanket with some tea.
And I just want to close this interview with a completely, maybe not so random, but definitely not a serious question.
Do it.
Which is, seeing how much the story revolves around ice cream, what's your favorite commercial flavor? And then what would be your favorite organic Mischief Creamery flavor?
So that's the thing about The Summer of Bitter and Sweet. There's a lot going on in the book, but there's still like the sweetness of teen life, and there's tons and tons of ice cream. My favorite commercial flavor, hands down, is mint chocolate chip ice cream. I want it super, super green, and I don't want like chocolate shavings. I want like chocolate chunks. And then I'm a little boring. I'll like own up to that. So my favorite Mischief Creamery flavor would probably be one of the summer berries. Like, I love raspberry and strawberry, and Saskatoon berry is delicious. If you get a chance to try Saskatoon berry,
I want
dessert.
To after reading this book and reading about it. It's like, I really need to find a place that makes ice cream like this. We've been talking with Jen Ferguson. The book is The Summer of Bitter and Sweet. Jen, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks very much. I enjoyed talking with you.
And that's where we close the book on this chapter. Next time, we chat with the first Black woman to visit every country in the world and the new photo book chronicling her journeys. Major case of envy. Until then, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at WCBS880Books. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to this podcast in the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lisa Chernkovich.